Good morning. You're listening to Oklahoma Voices on KGOU. I'm Kurt Gwartney. Politics is always interesting, but especially in the southern U.S. And on today's program, we have three experts that may even call them the godfathers of southern politics: Keith Gaddy at the University of Oklahoma, Chuck Bullock from the University of Georgia, and Scott Buchanan with the Citadel. Gentlemen, welcome and thank you for coming in today.
Thank you for having us.
Morning, Kurt.
I want us to just start off with the big question, at least for me, which is, I know we could probably just ask one question and you guys could go on and on about this, but it's the rise of the Republican Party and the demise of the Democratic Party in southern states like Oklahoma. Whoever would like to take that on first, we'll just start in.
Well, Keith, if you want to start off with Oklahoma, it better be you.
Well, we can
elaborate on that once you get beyond Oklahoma.
Okay. Well, Kurt, the first question has always been, is Oklahoma southern? And, I used to say years ago the South started somewhere in the Okefenokee Swamp and ended somewhere in the northwest corner of my backyard in Norman. And I stand by that. Oklahoma is a southern state. The five civilized tribes were slaveholding. They fought with the Confederacy. Had Oklahoma been a state in 1861, it most likely would have seceded. But, in these states, this Democratic Party dominance was established as much by identity as anything, not so much through organization, but the disorganization of politics. And, for decades and decades, really until the 1980s, anywhere you went in the South, you'd find Democratic Party dominance. And we've seen several drivers of political change that I'm sure Chuck and Scott can chime in on and elaborate on. But we, saw economic change that drove an initial wave of Republican growth and development, some movement of racial conservatives that prompted two-party competition. But especially here in Oklahoma and also across the South, the increased importance of evangelicals in state politics and the movement of the National Democratic Party away from the concerns of traditional rural and traditionally conservative Southerners.
Yeah, and once one of the things happens is that, he's talking about Democratic dominance. It was Democratic dominance, but there wasn't an organized Democratic Party usually. So once Republicans began to get a little momentum, then the Democratic Party often just imploded because they weren't used to going out and doing things like recruiting candidates and organizing voters because they never had to. In the past, open seat came up and you always had a crop of very good, very talented Democrats come forward to run. Once you had to recruit candidates, they didn't know how to do that. Republicans did.
If you look at a state like South Carolina, it initially began as a racial protest. But as the state changed, as more and more people from other areas of the country came in, they tended to be economically conservative, and that played into the hands of the Republican Party, certainly in South Carolina and the rest of the South as well, I would argue.
Scott, you mentioned South Carolina, and I know that Oklahoma gets compared to other southern states a lot. What trends have you seen over the past few decades that give you an idea of where we're headed? Are we locked into this now, or are you seeing anything that, looking at the past, may predict what happens a little bit in the future? Kind of tell me what you're seeing from your perspective.
Well, if you look at, and you mentioned South Carolina, so I'll use it as an example of this. It was once one of the most rural states of the Union. Now, nearly 70% of the population lives in urban and suburban areas of the state. If you look at what's going on in the state, it's been growing dramatically over the last two decades. We added a congressman in the 2010 redistricting round. If you look at where that population is going, it is going to primarily along the coast of South Carolina, some in the Greenville area, and some overflow from Charlotte. But if you look at that migration, it is primarily in South Carolina, a wider non-southern migration into the state, which tends to be almost libertarian in its economic leanings. And I think that's one of the areas, if you look in South Carolina, where Republicans have been growing, it's been through that those economically conservative voters. And if I could go one step further, I'd highlight a recent congressional election we had in South Carolina. It was a special election to replace the seat vacated by U.S. Senator Tim Scott. Mark Sanford returned to the Congress, and if you looked, he had personal flaws and controversies about him, And yet he won by almost 10 percentage points over his Democratic opponent.
But.
yes, Chuck.
Yeah. When we look at the demographic changes that are taking place, the South is becoming – well, the developing South. So, you know, North Carolina, Georgia, Florida, Texas particularly, becoming increasingly diverse. And this diverse population is a population that's inclined to towards the Democratic Party. So, although maybe everything except perhaps Virginia you would color some shade of red to pink, 10 years from now you probably aren't going to be doing that. And just give you kind of one bit of a factoid here. In Georgia, when you register to vote, you indicate your race. So we know what the makeup is of the electorate. Those people actually go and cast votes. 1996, 78% of the votes that were cast in Georgia came from whites. In 2012, it was just over 61%. Now, you've got a Republican Party that draws almost exclusively from white voters, doesn't get much out of the black, the Hispanic, or even the growing Asian populations. Most children who are born in Georgia now do not have white mothers. So unless the Republican Party comes up with a much broader and more encompassing message, then at some point a party that appeals only to white voters is just going to run out of white voters in terms of being able to win statewide elections. Aren't there yet? We may begin to see this, though, as early perhaps as 2018.
Yeah. Keith, what do you think about that?
Well, you know, Kurt, I'll bring that home to Oklahoma, which is that if you look at the citizen population of Oklahoma that's under 20 years old, majority of those Oklahoma citizens do not have a white mother. They are either Native American, African American, Hispanic, or Asian American. In my citizen population, that means that the future electorate, that next generation electorate, is a non-majority white electorate. You go 20 years out from now, you're looking at an Oklahoma where in excess of 40% of the potential electorate will not be white. Right now it's running in the high 80s. So we're looking at a substantial change of the demographic basis of politics in this state as well.
What are some of the other demographic changes since we've kind of gotten on to demography that you see that we should be paying attention to or at least the party should be paying attention to? Talking about urbanization, talking about diversifying populace. What are some of those others?
Right now, the electorate is divided, you know, various parts of it. The minority vote is a very much a solidly Democratic vote, black vote especially, but also these other minority groups are predominantly Democratic. The Republican base essentially is white males. Okay, what does that leave us then kind of in play? Well, it's white females. And there you've got a division between those who are married and those who are single. You know, the married white woman tends to be a Republican voter. The single white woman, whether she's divorced, never married, whatever, tends to be a Democratic leaning vote. So that's what we're going to see, I think, first coming into play as Democrats try to put together a coalition which would be based heavily upon these minorities. But if they can get enough of the white women vote, then they begin to win some races that they haven't won in the last 10 to 20 years.
I would say, going back to the more demographic issue going on, you look over the last 50, 60 years, the South has grown by over 100% in its total population if you look at the entire region. The country, and it's one thing that we need to be aware of, and I'm not sure how many are aware of how much the South has grown. It's no longer the rural region that it once was, and it's become much more urban. I do agree that the Democrats are going to do better for the foreseeable future in those urban areas, and that's something the Republicans will have to deal with. The other factor is that as that population of the South grows, it grows in power in the U.S. House, the Electoral College. So there are broad implications to this population growth.
Kurt, there's another demographic to think about which has to do with religious identity. Evangelicals have driven the last stage of realignment of the South, and these divisions on social issues, this 30-year, 40-year culture war that we've been engaged in that starts with the abortion issue in 73, it's really sort of peaked out. Current president of the Southern Baptist Convention, Fred Luter, and actually we were talking about this the other day at another event, has come out arguing for the depoliticization of the Southern Baptist Convention. Baptists are losing adherents, losing younger adherents in particular, and what they're encountering among young evangelicals, especially in the Baptist church but also in the non-denominational churches, is a desire to move away from social conservatism, the usual politicized issues, and increase receptivity to social gospel. The reason this is interesting, Chuck and Scott can confirm this, is if you look at those areas of religious appeal in the African-American community and also in the Protestant Hispanic community, it comes out of either a social gospel or out of a charismatic Christian experience. And the social gospel plays into issues that matter to the Democratic Party and create a different kind of coalition you might find between Democratic Catholics and liberal Democratic evangelicals.
Growing up in Oklahoma, and I remember – you know, if you did want to vote, you had to be a Democrat, and then that changed, and it was in large part the Christian evangelicals that moved that along. How does that play out in the other states in the South? Where is the Christian evangelical movement? Is Keith right? Are we seeing that across the states?
You know, I would say that it is a generational thing. I was speaking to a group yesterday about this very fact. That if when I talk to my college students about where they stand on these social issues, and they come from evangelical Christian backgrounds, and their parents and grandparents tend to come at it from the perspective where the government should ban abortions, the government should prevent same-sex marriage, but for those younger generation, those under 30, it's not those are not generally issues that resonate with them. They're not that concerned about that. Despite what their personal opinions may be, they're not as concerned about that. And so that's an area I think the Republican Party has to deal with. If they're going to get those under 30s to support them, they can't be the same party that their parents and grandparents.
Yeah, but it's going to take a while for that actually to, I think, really have its full impact, because right now the people who are showing up and voting in Republican primaries tend to be older. We know young people don't vote that much. And those older voters who are overwhelmingly evangelical and who still embrace these old social preferences. And so you're going to continue to see, I think, some very conservative people getting nominated by the GOP, which then opens the door potentially as the demographics change for a more moderate Democrat to be well positioned to then in the general election, where you're more likely to get a more diverse electorate showing up, to then be able to trump some of the very conservative people coming out of the GOP. And to some extent, that's what we saw in Virginia, you know, with the loss of the governor who had taken very firm positions, particularly on abortion. And he loses, you know, and this breaks a 40-year tradition in which Virginia votes for the party of governor for the party that's not in control of the White House.
I'm thinking about the way that growing up, the way it was in Oklahoma, and I'll just use my own experience, where that, you know, we had Democrats in Congress, but we always voted for the Republican for president. Mm-hmm. And are we even seeing this now? I thought about this about Virginia, mm-hmm. that in congressional elections, the Republicans might have a better chance because it's a specific area, whereas winning statewide, mm-hmm. when you have that diversity you mentioned earlier and you have the increased numbers living in more urban areas, well, then it's more of a toss-up. Are we seeing that? Are we seeing kind of this happen in different states?
Well, there are two places where I think you're seeing this happen in the South, and that'd be Virginia and Florida. Because you look at Virginia and Florida, Florida has been, won by the Democrats in four of the last six or five of the last six elections, depending on how you count,
right,
2000.
Yeah, presidential elections.
Yeah, and Virginia has been won twice in a row by the Democrats now. Yet if you look at the congressional delegations, the Republicans dominate these delegations.
Even 11 in Virginia, yeah.
Yeah, and I think what is it now? It's 18 out of 27 in Florida, something like that. Even with redistricting reform in Florida, Republicans still dominate. And part of this goes to the application of federal law. You start packing in minority voters into majority-minority districts designed to assure the election of a candidate of choice in those districts. What you leave behind is necessarily a suburban or a rural, bleached, predominantly white district, which is going to elect a Republican. And we've been doing this in the South now for, I guess, about 20-odd years under various Department of Justice regimes. So you look at Virginia, where a lot of Democrats are concentrated in the 3rd Congressional District and the 4th Congressional District of down around Richmond, the two most predominantly black districts in the state, and a lot of liberals are concentrated mainly in northern Virginia. Democratic votes packed in the congressional delegation, but it has a huge impact statewide. you know, same thing in Florida, but then you flip it on its head. This, in a sense, flips on its head what it used to be like. There was a heavily white vote statewide in all these southern states, and Republicans could dominate that white vote in presidential elections. But when you went down to the congressional districts, you had all these districts that were – and Chuck and I dealt with this in a book about a dozen years ago – districts that were roughly 23% to 40% African American or 23% to 40% Hispanic. And these districts, there were about 50 of these all over the South, and the Democrats would win all of them through a coalition of minority voters with whites. And those all got broken up in 1992, and then the Republicans take over the South in Congress. So now the new mantra of the Democratic Party in states like Georgia and Virginia and Florida and Louisiana and, well, everywhere, Texas, is coalitional districts. Let's put together districts that represent the diversity of the state, and you can put together a 40% minority vote with a 60% white vote, and the Democrats become competitive.
And one of the things that's helped the Republicans recently is that they got to draw almost all the districts after the 2010 mm-hmm. because they, by that point they'd taken up most of the southern state legislatures. And so, yeah, we're going to see, I think, a repeat of what used to be, as Keith touched upon, where in the past it was Democrats who could continue to hold on to the state legislature and Congress even though they couldn't win the presidency. We may see the same thing that play off on the other side where it's going to be Republicans who are pretty well dug into Congress and state legislature and hold on even as they begin to lose governorships and perhaps and the presidency.
Scott, have there been any major surprises that you've seen in the last several years in terms of any political races and things that you've covered closely when you looked at it and you thought, well, I kind of understand how this is going to work, and then when it turns out it was different?
You know, the 2010 first congressional district race in South Carolina, we had an incumbent who retired. And it set off a free-for-all in the Republican primary. First district's about plus 15 Republican as far as its voting tendencies. Nine Republicans run, two of which come from well-known political families in South Carolina. One was the son of Strom Thurmond, U.S. senator for many, many years from South Carolina. The other was the son of a very popular recent governor of the state of South Carolina, Governor Carroll Campbell, his son. And neither Campbell nor Thurmond won that particular nomination. It was Tim Scott, who is African-American. He is very conservative and is the darling of the Tea Party in South Carolina. Tim Scott won very, very easily in over Thurmond. And one of the things that is interesting to note is if you looked at the precincts in that district that were right along the coast, have lots of people who are not native to the state or the region, Scott was blowing Thurmond away. Thurmond was winning the precincts that were more in the interior of the district, more rural, where people had some knowledge, okay, of who Thurmond was. So that one, in a sense, is a surprise of how easily Scott won the nomination. I think it also indicates that there are voters in the South who are white and conservative or willing to vote for minority candidates. For that matter, if you look in South Carolina, the governor of South Carolina, Nikki Haley, Indian American, there's a willingness there if the ideological positions mesh together. If I could just sort of take that out one more step, again with the state of South Carolina, is that in 2010, Nikki Haley, going into the spring, was running a distant third in any of the opinion polls for the gubernatorial nomination with Sarah Palin's endorsement of Haley in 2010. I've never seen anything like this. She almost overnight was the leader in any opinion polling. She nearly won the nomination without a runoff over a former congressman. So I've never quite seen an endorsement do that sort of thing, because I usually say, endorsements, politicians love them because my personal theory is they're more superstitious than baseball players think about being. They love the endorsements, but for the most part, do many people actually go out and vote on the basis of an endorsement? But I think the Nikki Haley nomination is an example. Yeah, it made a huge difference because there were no polls indicating that she was anywhere near being the front runner, and seemingly overnight she was.
Well, that is a surprise. You mentioned the Tea Party, and I want us to talk about the Tea Party's influence in the South and its rise, but also it seems to be changing too.
Well, Chuck's got a new book on the Tea Party that just came out, so he's probably the best bet on this.
The Tea Party was a bit slow taking root in the South, in part because Southern Republicans were already so conservative. So where you first really began to notice them were, you know, right in the West in 2010 in Colorado and Nevada and places like that. But now, yeah, the Tea Party is probably stronger in the South than other parts because what we're beginning to see is that in some other parts of the country, Republicans are beginning to back away from that, and probably Chris Christie would be the best example of that. But in the South, Republicans are scared to death. They're almost scared right now of the Tea Party than they were Sarah Palin. Not to dispute what Cook said here about South Carolina, but Palin tried to do the same thing in Georgia, and it just didn't take hold. Right. Where she endorsed the woman there, and woman ended up losing, although she led in the primary. But yeah, so what you see is Republicans staking out very conservative positions because they're scared to death in the South that the Tea Party will mount a challenge against them in the primary. So what I think really is going to have to happen is several instances in which the Tea Party comes in against an individual, perhaps an incumbent, and says, this incumbent is a rhino. We don't want to see them. We want to replace them with a true believer. And then the incumbent nonetheless cleans the clock of the Tea Party nominee. And I think that then people then say, well, okay, so the Tea Party thing is also a bit overvalued in terms of what it can do.
And, you know, there's nothing new about Tea Party political values in Southern politics. It's, you know, Kurt, you and I have talked about this before where we've made the observation that we always had Tea Party politics in Oklahoma. We just didn't know what to call it. Mm-hmm. And it gave us a label. But, I mean, you know, it used to be these politics from the Democratic Party. You go back to Georgia and the right-wing urologist, Larry McDonald, would have made a fine Tea Partier. And there's this convergence of sort of 10th Amendment, states' rights politics with John Birch, anti-communist political thought that's always been in Southern politics. And I mean, it's been here for a century. When you go back and you look at the opposition of the Southern Tenant Farmers Union Organization, the Mississippi and Arkansas Delta back at the end of the 19th century, part of this was an anti-red movement. You see it here in Oklahoma in the 1920s with the pushback against the socialists and the pushback against the folks trying to organize the sharecroppers down in the southern part of the state. So there's not a lot new to it. It's always been sort of a small businessman, anti-communist, if we're going to pronounce it right, anti-communist movement that was designed to get back to sort of the true virtues of a Protestant America.
But what is significant, though, is it did mobilize a bunch of people to come out and vote in the Republican primary.
Yeah, it gave them rhino hunting licenses.
That's right.
Absolutely,
yeah.
You know, to follow up on what both of my distinguished colleagues have said, you know, the Tea Party, I was thinking about this recently. You can trace it back in a sense. There's, you know, the populist movement of the late 19th century. I mean, this time of great economic upheaval, social change going on, and this movement of, you know, that occurred over a century ago. And in some senses, I think you can see some strands of that going on. So, you know, in that sense, is it completely new? Well, it's a new label, but I'm not sure this is actually a new phenomenon. And to follow up on something you mentioned, Chuck, Bradley Byrne in Alabama won a special, Republican runoff down in the first district. Alabama near the Mobile area. That district has been held by a Republican since 1965. And if you look at it, Byrne had a challenger, Tea Party challenger, Dean Young, who did not win. Byrne won the nomination. But, you know, Dean Young has said, I'm not going to endorse Byrne. I'm not even going to call and concede to him. And I won't vote for him. And so sort of, you know, I was sitting there, I heard that, and I thought, what came to mind is a five-year-old saying, I'm taking my ball and going home. I mean, so I think, you know, until Republicans are willing to really confront this sort of thing, then, you know, the Tea Party could continue to cause them some problems.
Yeah, you know, Kurt Scott really kind of hit the nail on the head with the problem with the Tea Party and the Republican Party, which is there's – in politics to endure, you have to develop a certain maturity to understand when you have to negotiate and you have to bargain. And this is – so we have to remember, this is still an emerging social movement. It's a social movement. It's been around for – it's had been around with an identity for only 3.5 years. So it's still trying to figure out how to play ball to actually accomplish something, although many of the things they seek to accomplish are what everybody else would see as failure, like shutting down the government. Yeah, that's a success. Leave her shut down. And I think this is the challenge for that movement in the long run is learning how not to just pick up a football, tuck it under their arm, stick their fingers in their ears, and then stomp their feet because they didn't win.
But isn't it true of very conservative movements, regardless of – well, and you could say this about extremes, I think, on either end. But you can't negotiate because you have a list. I mean, if you can't negotiate. You can't give in.
Yeah, I was moderating a debate in a congressional district. I was already looking towards 2014, and there was one person who very much identified himself as the Tea Party. And each time a question would come to him, he would go to his list about we've got to get rid of EPA and the environment. Education and this, that, and the other. And he even started talking about we got to kind of cut back on national defense, which for Republicans usually is kind of a no-no. And finally I said to him, well, it sounds like to me the only thing you would have the federal government doing is running the Smithsonian,
Then did he write that down on the list?
Yeah, probably, yeah. Get rid of
they
that, too.
They privatized that.
Right, yeah. Yeah, so they do have their lists. And so it's a kind of a – very simplistic approach to government, but people in a time of turmoil and change often want very simple answers, things which are easy to understand rather than kind of looking at it and seeing it in a nuanced world. So,
well, it is attractive. And if you go to your typical congressional town hall meeting, at least the ones I go to around here, those are also the people who are showing up at those events as well.
Exactly.
And are we seeing that across the South?
Yeah, I was sharing the story yesterday, but as an example of how the Tea Party is causing some problems for the Republicans, a former student of mine worked for Georgia congressman a couple years back, and his job was to go around to the county party meetings, the county commission meetings, and he was telling me at one of the county Republican Party meetings that a woman associated with the Tea Party got up and read off this list of things. We need a congressman who'll do this, that, and the other. And so as soon as the meeting was over, he made a point of going over to her and saying, well, ma'am, your congressman, he agrees with you, and he has cast votes, and he listed a number of different votes along these lines. And she gave him sort of a befuddled look and then said, well, you ought to do it louder. And turned around and walked off. And so, this sort of, if I can borrow a term from the 1850s, this sort of know-nothingism that, pervades is endemic right now, I think, with the many in the Tea Party.
Well, and, Kurt, this is the big problem for Republican incumbents. These largely sensible, very conservative, business-oriented incumbents who nonetheless came to govern. And, we're fortunate we have Tom Cole who is very good at this. But for many of them, they get scared by the prospect of a challenge from the right within the primary. So you have these safe districts like we talked about before. And for the Republicans, this Tea Party can't go far enough right. And it keeps going further and further right, and it keeps pulling these members out. And I'm reminded of the words of Richard Russell dealing with a similar issue with regard to civil rights. Russell was not an integrationist by any stretch. But when asked about his taking part in a filibuster against the Civil Rights Act, when he had always promised to be quiet on these things, he told a reporter, he said, off the record, from time to time, one must rise below one's principles. And we will find these members taking these positions or taking these votes that are in conflict with how they really think we ought to govern just to avoid a challenge.
And to follow up on something you just mentioned, Keith, somehow in our political discourse, pragmatism and compromise have become dirty words on both sides. And I tell my students when we go throughout American government, if you look, compromise is where the business of politics is done, and when you have both sides just yelling at one another and no middle anymore.
Well, Scott, don't you think that maybe what we have now is we have politics with some governing rather than governing with some politics?
No, you could say that.
Yeah. Well, what we got is politicians who sing the virtues of democracy, except when it comes to someone running against them. And what they particularly dislike are primary challenges. Although I think if you look at it, sure, you've got a few high-profile items like Utah, which is a unique case because you do things during a convention where indeed an incumbent senator who is very conservative gets replaced by Mike Lee. But I think what you'd find is if you did any kind of systematic study is that the Tea Party has not knocked off many people in primaries. So it's not that indeed if you, cross swords with them, you're destined, you're doomed to defeat. But the fear still maintains, and that motivates your behavior.
What's the South's role now in national elections? What role do these states play, or is it even a role? Are there many roles? Are there different roles or different areas? How would you carve that up and talk about the influence of the South in national politics?
Well, it depends what you're talking about. It's executive or legislative branch. In terms of the executive branch, presidential elections, the South is now, as has been through most of the history since 1860, and that is it is out of step with the rest of the nation, that it is far more Republican, and therefore, in essence, it isn't having much influence over the choice of a president. But the South, again, historically, has had disproportionate influence when it came to Congress. Someone once characterized that the role of the South in Congress was its everlasting revenge for Appomattox. So Southern Republicans don't dominate the Republican Party in Congress. They don't clearly dominate the Congress in terms of their numbers, but they are now setting the tone for the stands taken by Republicans in the House, and Republicans are going to continue to control the House at least until 2022, and if they get to redraw districts after that, on into the next decade.
Yeah, the last 10 presidential elections where at least 10 Southern states hung together, the South got its choice for president because the South represents a huge block of electoral college votes. What if we include Oklahoma, it's what almost 180 electoral college votes just out of the South, 170 roughly. So it is a big block of votes. It'll get you 2/3 of the way there. The problem is, and I've heard Chuck talk about this many times, and Scott and myself, there used to be this big L, and it was called the Finkelstein box after a Republican consultant. And it's this L-shaped box that takes in the Mountain West, the Plain States, and the South. And as long as the Republicans can – whoever can dominate that box can win the presidency with great ease. The problem is ever since California became diverse enough that it dropped out and went Democratic, the Republicans have had a terrible time winning the presidency and have been incapable of winning the presidency without completely dominating the South. You break away two Southern states. You look at presidential elections since 1992. There are only two elections where at least 10 Southern states hang together, and the Republicans win those two elections. But if you took away any one Southern state, they would have lost. I think that's rather telling, but it also gives the Republicans this huge and disproportionate block of House seats that they've got locked in. They generally win, and they just have to combine that with suburban pickups here and there. They can control the U.S. House. So I think we're stuck with divided election because of the South, divided government because of the South. I would check probably for at least the next 7 years, 8 years?
Yes.
Yeah.
Scott, what do you say about that?
Yeah. Nothing huge to add to that. So, I mean, they both cover pretty much the gamut. But I would say, broadly speaking, that if you as far as the South's power in the U.S. House, especially if you look, Texas is the second most populous state. It's an enormous number of seats. Florida, enormous number. Georgia, North Carolina. So I agree. I don't see anything changing before 2022. And quite possibly, as Yogi Berra once said, it's tough to make predictions, especially about the future. But the bottom line is that I don't see much change before 2022.
Well, what it really does underscore the significance of the 2018 round of elections in determining who's going to be in charge of redistricting in 2021. And a number of these southern states – Democrats have no chance of taking back the state legislatures, but they might be able to win the governorship. And if they do, then you're going to get bipartisan plans being drawn for the next decade, the decade of the 2020s. But in those states in which Democrats can't take back the governorship, they're destined to be in the minority on until 2032.
Yeah.
So do you think that Republican dominance in many states in the South leads to kind of what has been called kind of an echo chamber effect, so that you get we're isolated. We're used to use the word out of step, Chuck, but we're not out of step. Everybody's out of step with us. And we get things like no expansion of Medicaid, efforts to delay the Federal Affordable Care Act, those kind of things. How does one party's dominance cause things like that to happen, or does it, I guess I should ask?
Yeah, let me kind of take issue with you. I think this opposition to Medicaid and things like this, I think what would happen if Democrats were still in control of much of the South. What I think is the difference is between today's Democratic – Republican control and the Democratic control of the past is the old Democrats were equally conservative on a whole range of social welfare issues, but they were willing to make investments in the future. They were willing to spend money to improve infrastructure. They were willing to spend money on education, and they saw this as a means by which you attracted industry to come in from the North. Today's Republicans aren't willing to do that. What their touchstone is, no new taxes, and go beyond that, cut some of the existing taxes. And if that's your whole philosophy, then you don't have the resources to make those investments to make an area attractive to outsiders.
You know, to follow up on what Chuck just said, the state of South Carolina at one point in time had what was considered to be one of the best transportation systems in the Union. Now, roads are falling apart, but you have a consistent opposition among the Republican leadership, Republican rank and file in the state legislature to do anything. There are proposals to raise the gas tax, which is one of the lowest in the union, to raise the gas tax only to be attacked as, you know, oh, you're a tax and spend liberal. Like, well, wait a minute. This is going to be earmarked specifically for roads. Who's against roads? Well, you know, you have that opposition among the Republicans to any kind of tax.
Yeah, the difference is that the Democratic philosophy was you needed to have some investment to make the place attractive. Republican philosophy is the only thing that makes it attractive is low taxes. That's what will attract industry and investment.
And if I could follow up, you know, one of the things that you hear from the Republicans all the time is privatize it. Well, there's some things that private industry can and will not do. And I think Democrats historically were willing to say, okay, there's certain roles like in higher education, whatever else, for the government. But Republicans are more likely than not to say, let the private market do it.
And, you know, what's funny about that is that's where a conservative's favorite science, the dismal science economics, would agree. There are things that only government can do, the creation of public goods, the creation of collective goods. The marketplace won't create them, but the marketplace wants to take advantage of them. You know, this is where we go back to that Alabama 1 runoff, this is where things get interesting because the Chamber of Commerce has finally decided to come to play. And they're going to be putting a lot of money into primaries and engaging in a lot of pushback. So, you know, this is actually a good lesson for Southern politics is that if you look back at the old Southern Democratic politics and you look back to mine and Chuck and Scott's favorite state, Georgia, with all due respect to my Oklahoma neighbors, in the 1930s, we had these two gentlemanly U.S. senators from Georgia, Walter F. George and Richard B. Russell, both of whom were challenged by a populist, conservative, limited government, low tax. What's a good word to describe Gene?
Redneck
named Gene Talmadge. And Gene had this little 100,000 that would vote for him, and the thought was Gene could come in and overwhelm these men in debate out there on the hustings and win
certainly
these primaries.
Certainly more entertaining.
Absolutely much more entertaining, and that's a whole other show. But what he found out is these gentlemen could come to fight, and the chamber is discovering that gentlemen have to come to fight if they're going to prevail in politics. And I think that is – if you want an old lesson from Southern politics – for the business community about how you deal with the chamber, you go back and you look at those gentlemanly Southern Democrats and how they manage these demagogues or mismanage them in the case of Huey Long. I think you learn a great deal about what will be happening in the GOP primary the next several years.
So what are some of your favorite lessons? Keith just told us one story, but I'm always curious, people who closely study something like this over a period of time, what's one of your favorite lessons that you think come out of what you've seen in Southern politics over the decades?
Yeah, this question I'm not prepared for. I have to think about this for a second.
I'm glad I'm not the only one. I'm sitting there going.
I can tell you. Go ahead, Chuck.
Yeah. No.
I'll tell you my favorite name, Larry Boogaloo Cooper, who ran for lieutenant. Larry Boogaloo Cooper ran for lieutenant governor of Louisiana, promising to abolish the office.
What's fascinating about the South, and this may not be a lesson, what's fascinating about the South has been that it has been the region which has undergone the most dramatic change over the last 40 or 50 years. I mean, you don't have to go back terribly long, indeed, in my lifetime, where you had essentially an all-white, male, democratic, rural-dominated political system. And now none of those things prevail. It is not democratic. It is certainly not rural as a result of the redistricting efforts. Indeed, the last rural white male Democrat to serve in the Georgia Senate retired in 2012 when his district was carved up. If you go from Charlotte, North Carolina to Houston, Texas, you'll find one white Democrat serving in Congress. So we've had these two dramatic forces that have been changing the politics of the region. One has been the emergence of two-party competition, and the other has been the mobilization of an African-American vote. So, you know, change is interesting in all parts of the country, and the South is not unique in having gone change. But if you draw out, and Keith and I, one of his graduate students, did an article several years ago, where if you look at the presence of Republicans in public office, you know, state legislature, congressional delegations, you know, go back into the 1950s, in a sense, you're at zero. Now in any one of those four chambers, the two chambers of Congress and state legislative houses and senates, these are now all majority Republican. If you were looking at the presence of African Americans, again, 1950s, you're at zero. Now, you know, you have literally, you know, thousands and thousands of African Americans holding offices all the way from the Senate in South Carolina, U.S. Senate, down to dominating county school boards and commissions in many parts of the South.
As I've been thinking about this, you know, we had a former governor of Georgia who once made the comment that Georgia voters every spring take a dose of castor oil. In the summer, they get the Sears Roebuck catalog, and in the fall, they vote for Democratic candidates. And, you know, to follow up, we've seen the end of that one-partyism. And in some senses, in some counties of the various states, you've seen one-partyism end for the Democrats but then come into place for the Republicans. I think you can look at the region and see the problems with one-partyism that that Chuck's touched on. But when you have one-party dominance, you get sloppy. You fall asleep at the wheel. You don't do the candidate recruitment. And I think to echo on something that V.O. Key, the true godfather of Southern politics, he talked about the need for competitive two-party system, that it's not a good thing to have one party in dominance. Competition is a good thing, and I think you can see that going on in the South right now.
And of course, we have that here in Oklahoma, Keith. That, you know, we had all our statewide elected offices go Republican. Of course, the House and the Senate go Republican too. And do you think that lack of competitiveness is going to be something that will harm the Republican Party in Oklahoma going ahead?
Possibly in the long run, but with Oklahoma right now, the problem is that there's not a sufficient Democratic base vote, non-white Democratic base vote, to make them a competitive threat, either in most of the legislative seats or in statewide office or for Congress. So for right now, the game is largely in the GOP. The question, you know, we've always had a very tight Republican Party candidate recruitment machine here, and it has generally succeeded. And, you know, to some extent, the question mark becomes, at what point do we see candidates who can't win in the GOP drifting out to find different vehicles to run under, or we find people that would have been Democrats trying to horn their way into the Republican Party because that's where the power is, right? You always, you know, what was it Dave Walbert said? They just wanted to get their hands on the power. That's why people got into politics. So, you know, I think here in Oklahoma, the Republicans are in good shape for right now because they have viable recruiting mechanisms, and the Democrats still haven't built. When I was talking with a Democratic activist who shall remain nameless a couple of years back, and he said, you know, it ain't the death panels in Obamacare that scares us. It's the death panels in trying to get somebody to run for the Democratic nomination, because you run, you're dead. And, you know, it's just finding the candidates. Nobody wants to go out there and take a bullet for the party. I mean, an actual Democrat for governor hasn't emerged yet, and filing closes in about 4 months. Usually you'd have a field set and you'd have a competitive primary, and we've got nothing.
You're going to play on that a little bit. Kind of an interesting thing is happening right now in Georgia, and that is we're going to have our statewide election as well as a Senate contest in 2014. Democrats, like in Oklahoma, very, very short bench, and so they are all delighted that they have two second or even third generation candidates come forward. So that Michelle Nunn, Senator Nunn's daughter, is running for the Senate. She's never held public office herself. Jason Carter, a grandson of Jimmy Carter, announced he's running for the governorship. Now, on the one hand, yeah, Democrats are delighted because these are people who have a degree of name recognition, but it also underscores how short the bench is because, you know, here you've got people who don't have a whole lot of a political experience, in case of Michelle Nunn, no political experience, and yet they immediately move to the fore of the Democratic Party roster.
And in the case of South Carolina, with the Democratic bench being so shallow, it looks like the nominee for the Democrats next year in the gubernatorial contest will be Vince Shaheen, who was defeated by Nikki Haley in 2010. And the Democrats quite simply cannot come up with a viable candidate other than a Shaheen to do a rematch. And generally speaking, you got your one chance of, you know, getting the office. And if you couldn't do it the first time, it's very difficult to do it the second.
Yeah, Kurt, and to bring it back home, I think what Scott and Chuck point out to us is until you see some Borens and Kerrs and Henrys coming back again, Democrats probably don't go very far.
Taking a broad view of politics in the South, where do you see history repeating itself? In other words, you know, we've talked a lot about the change, and of course that has happened, but are there trends or the things where you've seen history repeat itself? It's like, here we are again.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the movement towards two-party competition began in what some people might argue are the least southern parts of the South. So they began in the Rim South states, and that's now where Democrats are beginning to stage their comeback.
And those states would be?
Virginia, North Carolina, Florida, the ones which voted at least once for Barack Obama. The really deep South states, Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama, they're now just kind of catching up in the sense that they have become overwhelmingly Republican within just the last 5 years in terms of their state legislature. And so my guess is that, you know, in terms of a Democratic resurgence, they're also going to be trailing behind the areas which are actually undergoing more growth, more change, because as Scott mentioned earlier, a lot of this change is coming from outside. And certainly historically, the early basis for the Republican Party often came from people who moved into the region and brought their partisanship with them. And so that's happening now in the D.C. area in Virginia. It's happening in the Research Triangle in North Carolina. Of course, all of Florida has been overtaken by all kinds of immigrants.
Well, you know, there's – if you really want to talk about maybe not so much history repeating itself as history sustaining itself, the rural South is in perpetual crisis, constantly losing population, constantly getting older.
And yep. As part of the rural South, never recovered from the Civil War.
No, it never did. And it did. You know, I mean, and indeed, you know, we look back at things like the New Deal and we think, you know, you have this infusion of agricultural money that comes into the South. Well, yes, there was an infusion of money because the cash disappeared from the rural South in the 1920s and 1930s. This infusion of cash allows large landowners to invest in mechanization, which throws large numbers of people out of work. And if you go to my wife's family's place in West Tennessee, you see there is a generation of old landowners who are mainly living in assisted living now or headed for it. And you have a generation of poor African Americans living in this Black Belt county who are living in Section 8 housing next to the fields that their grandparents used to tend. And many of them go off and tend these poor old dying white people in assisted living. So they've gone from tending one sort of cotton to another. But it is this general exodus, both from the Appalachian South and from the Black South and also from parts of Southwest Texas, the movement away. Any bright kid, black or white, who can get out gets out, and he probably doesn't come back. And it is the problem for the politics of these folks in this part of the country is they don't realize how small they've become in contrast to the rest of the state or the rest of their country. Years ago, Chuck and I were working a case together in Georgia, and South Georgia politicians were convinced they were still entitled to 50% of the power, even though they only had 15% of the people. And that is an enduring quality of Southern politics: perpetual economic crisis, perpetual poverty, and a perpetual desire to have an out of proportions share of political power.
I don't know if so much. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question or not, to be quite honest about it. History repeating itself, but to piggyback on something Keith just said, if you looked 70 years ago, you saw African Americans leaving the South in droves to places like Detroit, Chicago, New York, wherever. They're still migrating today, but they're just not migrating north of the Mason-Dixon line for the most part. If you look, they're moving into the urban areas of the South. They're not trying to flee from a segregated society that their grandparents would have been fleeing from. And indeed, we haven't touched on this, but there's been a return of blacks to the South over the last 15 years or so, and that's something that's continuing. So I think it is a fleeing from rural areas to urban. And if you go around the rural South, you know, there's some areas of the South you can go through and you kind of wonder, am I the last person on the face of the earth? And you can go miles without any sign of really human habitation. It's a dying area.
Well, and you know, Scott, you and I are an example of this in a way. I mean, you grew up in cotton country. I grew up in tobacco country, and we didn't want to pick and stick. So here we are.
There was a day and time when you could make a living on a farm. Not anymore.
Nope.
So what's the end game of that you're talking about of people living? So are we going to have large areas of abandoned countryside and have this urbanization that, looking, you know, even, you know, 50 years ago, no one would have imagined that could have happened?
I think you're already seeing it. I mean, I've got a cadet at the Citadel right now who's going back to his great-great-grandparents. They all raised tobacco. Well, his grandfather, 15 years ago, basically accepted government payments to start growing tobacco, planted the entire tobacco farm and pine trees. And so I think it's already going on, and I think that's a trend that will continue.
We have lots of good hunting. There are growing numbers of coyotes, bear, deer, and things like this, and wild hog, yeah.
Yeah.
Scott's right, and Kurt, I think if you want to bring it back home again, next time you and I take a drive around rural Oklahoma, mm-hmm. and we go rolling through Goaty Bow or Pink or Strangtown or someplace like that, we see these places that are emptying out, and you go through this town, and the only thing that's there is what used to be a video rental store and a blood donation place and a pawn shop and a place that used to be a 7-Eleven that's now a local grocery store that depends heavily on food stamp recipients to turn over business. You know, that dying South, that dying rural South, it's not everywhere in the rural areas, but it's in every Southern state that has any predominant swath of rural agriculture still at work.
That's really more than this. It's just dying rural America. Mm-hmm. You know, you see the same thing as in the upper Midwest, you know. And,
yep.
You know, we are an urbanized nation, and that's where opportunity is.
Right. But so long as there is a South, there will be a political movement that will cling to the Jeffersonian virtue of the farmer, of the yeoman farmer. And at the end of the day, that is fundamental to understanding Southern politics.
It does seem to be, because you have candidates, you know, trying to grab that, even if it's fairly remote. I mean, it's amazing how many of our politicians have worked on a farm. I'm just
Well, either in reality or in their imagination.
True.
So first of all, I just want to thank you all three for coming in today. And I want to give you a chance to talk about your latest project or studies that you're working on. And Chuck, do you want to start off?
Keith mentioned a book that the three of us are doing together, and this is a book on Gene Talmage, who we mentioned, one of the most colorful of the demagogues of the 1930s, when there were a lot of those across the South. And what we're really focusing on is a particular event that comes after he dies. After he dies, having been elected to serve again for his fourth term in Georgia, he doesn't quite make it to the inauguration. About 2-3 weeks beforehand, he dies, and this throws the state into crisis, where there are at one point three different individuals who claim they should be governor. One kind of by right of blood because it's the son of the dead governor. Another one kind of thinking of progression, he is the lieutenant governor. But this same election is the first time that Georgia ever elected a lieutenant governor, so there's no tradition of a lieutenant governor moving on. And certainly had he been inaugurated, he would take over, but he didn't ever get inaugurated. And then the third is the sitting governor who had wanted to do another term but couldn't get the Constitution changed to allow him to do this. And so he gets the attorney general, who's in his political faction, to rule that he can actually stay in office until they get this resolved. It definitely does get resolved, and that's kind of what we look at in this book.
Scott, what do you have going on?
I'm working, in addition to the book Chuck just mentioned, working on in the final edits of a book on the 2012 presidential election in the South, which was an outgrowth from the series of papers presented at the Citadel Symposium on Southern Politics. So I'm working on that. I'm also working on a book with a co-author on South Carolina government. So plenty of things to keep me busy.
And Keith, how are you?
Well, in addition to continuing to edit my journal, Social Science Quarterly, Chuck and I have got another project. We had a book a few years back called Triumph of Voting Rights in the South. Well, subsequent to that, a section of the Voting Rights Act was struck down by the Supreme Court in a case called Shelby County v. Alabama. So Chuck and I have been asked to do, along with my colleague Justin Word, a updated new version of the book, and it's called The Rise and Fall of the Voting Rights Act, and we'll be finishing that up for OU Press here in the near future.
Gentlemen, we look forward to those books, and again, thank you all so much for coming in.
Goodbye. Please do.
Thank you so much for inviting us.
Thank you for having us.
Pleasure as always, Kurt.